So thanks, Naish, for asking me to speak about causal sets. It's always great fun to introduce causal sets to people who haven't seen it. And there aren't many experts here, so I feel a little reassured that I'm not going to be repeating things that I say in talks. So the idea here in this talk is to set the stage for many of the discussions which will come later in the meeting. So it's just a broad overview of this way of doing quantum gravity. So I'll start off with this one object, which I call the causal structure poset, which is part of Lorentzian geometry, which is very much a feature of Lorentzian geometry. And the Hawking-King-McCarthy-Malamud theorem, which basically is a motivation, gives us the motivation for the causal set approach to quantum gravity. Then I'll go on to discussing the causal set hypothesis, which is that space-time is replaced by what's called a locally finite partially ordered set. Very crucial to the causal set hypothesis. So in other words, what one is saying is that rather than think about the space-time continuum, you have this discrete substructure, which is a causal set or a partially ordered set, and it has this property of it being locally finite. So causal set theory is a quantum theory of causal sets, but it also has a very important aspect to it, which is based on this motivation that comes from Lorentzian geometry, from continuum Lorentzian geometry. It is that you have to also, this approach includes a continuum approximation. In other words, how does a continuum arise from a causal set? Okay, so it's not just a theory of posets, of locally finite posets. It comes along with an assumption of a continuum approximation or a definition for the continuum approximation. And this is what we often call causal set kinematics. I'll also briefly describe something about quantum dynamics of causal sets. And then finally, sort of set the stage for what we mean by causal set phenomenology. It includes lambda, which is the focus of this meeting, but also some other things. I think we'll hear a little bit about the dark matter and also this way of thinking about particles that are moving on a discrete background called swerves. So most of the talk is introductory. Please feel free to ask questions. Oh, there's Rafi. Okay. So we had a round of introductions, so yeah.
That part, this is everybody.
Yeah, we can't do it. We can't do a two-way. Right, so in a Lorentzian space-time, we know that there are light forms, and this means that there's at least a definition of local causality. We know that there's a causality relation. There's also the relation of chronology, and the thing that's causality but not chronology is the Horismos relation, which is a null relation. And so we know this about Lorentzian spacetimes, that it has light cones, local light cones at every point in the tangent space. What is often not...
What is Horismos?
It's simply the null relation. So things that are causal, but not chronological. So which lie on the light cone. So when I have a spacetime and I look at the geodesics, I say time-like geodesics, space-like geodesics, and so on, and I construct relations on space-time events, whether they're space-like, time-like, or null. But I can just say, well, I have that, it came from the metric, but let me go back to the space-time and just think of the manifold, the set of events, as a set, okay? No more structure on it. And now the only structure you want to put on it is this causal relation. So you strip it of everything, and you say, let's just look at this fact that the metric, the Lorentzian metric, gives you this relation, and you now strip it of everything. So M is just a set of events, and I have a causal relation between the points. That causal relation is acyclic in a causal space-time, right? I don't want closed time like or closed causal curves. So it's acyclic, which means that if X precedes Y and Y precedes X, then in the convention I'm using, then X is the same as Y. It's also transitive because we know that light cones nest inside each other. Right? So that nesting property of light cones means that if X is before Y and Y is before Z, then X is also before Z, right? So we know that light cones nest, and this is a property of transitivity. And this makes this object a partially ordered set, okay? And you notice that all I have is a set of events and a relation between the points. Now, the question that people started to ask very early on is, how primitive is this structure? And it goes back to old ideas. I'm not sure if this is, I've written it chronologically, but very many people start to ask this question, how primitive is this structure? I mean, how essential is it to space-time? Can we ask how much of space-time is contained in just the causal structure poset? So one thing you know immediately, which is very simple to see, is that the causal structure remains invariant under conformal rescalings because we know that null relation goes to null relations, right? Under a conformal rescaling. So the light cone structure is invariant. So that means that the causality relations are invariant under conformal rescalings. The other thing to notice is that if I had two time directions instead of just one, okay, we know that, for example, in Riemannian spaces, there are no light cones, right? It's just plus, plus, plus signature, no light cones, nothing. So it comes in Lorentzian spacetime. Now you can ask, well, does the poset exist in other kinds of non-trivial signature spacetimes? And the fact is that if you had more than one time direction, and here's a three-dimensional projection in a four-dimensional case, which is the first time you'll encounter it non-trivially, which is two time directions and two space directions. And if you just look at the time directions and suppress one of the space-like directions, then you see that the time-like direction is connected. And this means that there's no before or after. Okay? So the idea of a poset relation, which is an ordering relation on the set of points, is deeply and intricately tied in with the nature of the signature, which is just one time direction. And that's why you have light cones, which meet only at a single point. You have cones. There's no light cone here, for example. There's no conical structure. This is just a fake conical structure here, because I've suppressed one direction, but there's no cone at all, right? So the fact that we have ordering at all, that we have causality, is deeply tied in and linked to this particular signature. Okay. So the question is, how much of space-time geometry? So it's very linked in with Lorentzian geometry. The question that people asked is, well, and we know that under conformal transformations, the causal structure remains invariant. Can we go the other way around, starting with just knowing the causal structure, how much of space-time can you reconstruct? Okay? And this was something that Zeeman asked very early on.
So this is the Zeeman effect, or is it different?
I think it's the same one, actually. I mean, I think I knew it, and then I forgot it, and then I forgot it again. But yeah, the time doesn't match. It's a different person. I thought okay. Okay, so then Rafael must be right. Yeah. So, but he seemed to have been very, I guess, yeah. So he's asked us. I mean, there are a few papers that he's written on this, and so what he did was just look at Minkowski spacetime itself. And look at the group of chronological automorphisms. Just to remind you, we have a poset for the causality relation, but even for the chronology relation. So if you just looked at time-like related things, you'd also find there to be a partially ordered set. And so if you, instead of this, you looked at the chronology relation, so you look at chronological automorphisms, that is, things that retain the chronological structure, the partially ordered relations and so on, there's an automorphism from Minkowski space that is to itself, then this group is isomorphic to the group of inhomogeneous Lorentz transformations and dilations, which is already very interesting because just starting from that Posset structure, you can get out the Lorentz transformations, this Lorentz group. Okay, so that's already, I think, a very nice result. So looking at this and, you know, I guess motivated by the general direction that people like Penrose, Fraunheimer, we're all trying to axiomatize this causal structure, trying to see how much of information about the space-time is contained there. There's this very beautiful theorem, a couple of theorems, one due to Hawking, King, McCarthy, and another generalization due to Malamud, which we just write as one single theorem, which is that if you had two space-times, okay, and each with their own causal structure, okay, the own causal structure Posset, and you had a bijection between them, which is a one-to-one onto mapping between these, just set theoretically, right? I mean, no other information. Then, and you put in this particular condition that it's a very weak causality condition on the space-time, which is that it's future and past distinguishing. I can tell you this later, what it means. Then you find that that also induces a smooth conformal isometry between the two spacetimes. In other words, if this is true, that there exists a causal bijection between them, that means that the causal structure Posset of this is the same as the causal structure Posset of the other, then the two metrics are related by a conformal transformation. You can also generalize, you can also see, there's also a, okay, so maybe your last.
Sorry, I'll have to finish your.
Just to say that you, even if you took spacetimes of different dimension, you can show that, and there was a causal, if there exists a causal bijection, then also you find that the dimensions are the same, and then also, then, yes. Please go ahead.
I just want to maybe recap so I don't lose.
Sure, of course. Yeah, please, yeah.
Because these are concepts that I need to digest. So N is the starting set of this fundamental object, and then you define a relation, causal relation.
Yes.
Between them, and together they make a Posset.
Yes.
So it's a set with.
With a relation on it.
Relations defined on, the
on it.
Okay.
And this one that I'm talking about is the one that you get from space-time. So I'm still not, yes. So I'm not yet coming, I'm still motivating it from Lorentzian geometry. So I'm saying take your space-time, and then you have your light cones on it, and you know then from there you get relationship between whether things are time-like, space-like, or null, you can get all that information. And now throw away that the metric and just keep the relation, the information you have about the relations.
I see. So you want to start with the metric and derive the implied causal connections between the fundamental elements of the set.
Yes. I mean, in this case, we're not even, before we're coming to causal set theory, we're just saying in a Lorentzian manifold, in a Lorentzian spacetime, you have a manifold and you have a whole differentiable structure. You can put a Lorentzian metric on it, all of that. But now from that, I want to extract this partially ordered set with M, with this relation. But that M is now the same as your manifold, except we don't need any of the structure on the manifold. We just have the points. And then the relation between points. So you can think of it now as a set, and this will motivate the causal set approach, where yes, we will then replace, we will just be thinking about a set.
Okay, so let me just, so my question was that, do you derive the metric from
the set and the history is defined on the set, but you're saying you actually go the other way.
Right, no, I'm to motivate it.
Like a design, you know which metric you want, that's Minkowski, and then you derive back the kind of set you need to give you the Minkowski metric.
Right now, so let me, I think maybe just to sort of put it in broader perspective. So right now, all I'm doing is motivating from Lorentzian geometry why we will, once we would ultimately come to this point where we throw away everything, we just have a set, and we have to do the reverse. We want to get out the continuum from the set. Right now, we're saying, why is this proposal there in the first place? Just to sort of motivate it. So I'm still working with the continuum. And then I'll throw away the continuum. Then we can ask that question, you know, starting from the discrete structure, how do we get out the continuum? That's going to be part of...
Maybe one comment. You don't need to know you're looking for a Minkowski, for a flat metric, or any specific metric. As long as there was some metric, it can be recovered just from the causal information up to conformal factor. It could be curved, it could be anything.
Yeah, there's no, out here, this theorem
the
applies for...
Maybe that one does know. I think you do.
Yeah, there it is Minkowski. But here it's just for any two future and past distinguishing space-time. So I have a very weak causality condition. So any Lorentzian, so M1 and M2 can be two space, M1, G1, M2, G2, or two space-times, which are very general. They just have to be satisfying this condition of, yeah.
I didn't mean Minkowski.
Okay.
Specifically Minkowski,
okay.
But
just
formally, like,
yeah.
Minkowski is
yeah.
Anything that's...
Yeah,
that was clear.
Yeah, okay.
I looked up this first Zeeman died before the paper was published. One of the same.
Okay, so it's another Zeeman then, altogether. Okay. Okay. So the thing that you learn then is that order, I mean, so what does the Hawking-Malliman theorem tell you? It tells you that order is most of geometry, because if I think about this coset, which is what I'm calling order, then it contains everything but all but one of the components of the metric. The only thing that's missing is a scalar, which is a conformal factor. It's just one. So as Finkelstein said, causal structure is 9/10 of the space-time geometry, and the remaining 1/10 is the volume element. And so what this theorem tells us is that we can think of continuum Lorentzian space-time as being made up of causal structure plus the volume element. So this decomposition of thinking about space-time in terms of causal structure is something that is sort of the point at which causal sets, this causal set approach then uses as a springboard to its, all right? So this is simply in the continuum. So the causal set hypothesis, and there were early ideas by Mirheim, but it's set out in sort of an almost complete description, at least in terms of what, where the elements of the theory are in this paper in 1987. And that is that you start with the causal structure coset. So we had causal structure plus volume, and we see that without the volume element, you can't get out space-time geometry, you can only get out the conformal class. So now the idea is to take the causal structure, and we need something which will put in the volume element. So what is that? And that is simply the assumption of space-time discreteness. So in other words, we're taking the causal structure coset, but we're looking at a discrete version of it, a subset, a much, much smaller subset of it. Causal structure coset is uncountable, and you want to have a countable subset. And the space-time discreteness says, the idea is that if I have a space-time volume, and here, an easy way of thinking about it is just between the clicks of my two fingers, there's a space-time volume that I've generated, which is the future of this event and the past of the second event. Okay? That gives me a space-time volume region. And the idea is in that region, you have a finite number of space-time events. So we think of a continuum. We think of finite volumes having infinite events. That's the continuum for you. But here we're saying there's an important ingredient, and that is that of discreteness. Okay? And what does discreteness do? It supplies for you a number which is that volume element, okay, that was missing. So you have order, you have number, and the idea, this is the slogan due to Raphael Sorkin, which is sort of the slogan of causal set theory, which is that order plus number gives you space-time geometry. But of course, there has to be a wiggle there because it can't give you exactly the continuum because we've made an assumption about a fundamental discreteness. The continuum is irrelevant. It's a fiction of our imagination. There's actually only a discrete number of space-time events. And that, therefore, when we say space-time geometry in terms as a continuum object, it's an approximation to something that's fundamentally discrete. Okay. Yes?
So if I understand it correctly, at this level, the underlying space is a continuous topological set, and you're imposing on that continuous structure some discrete points in the continuous structure.
So that's the way I've motivated it, but I want to throw all the continuum away. Yes, I will throw it away. So very soon. Yeah.
In the sense that, to begin with, if you assume it's a manifold, it's homeomorphic to something, this discrete structure carries that property with it?
So that would be something that we will see. You would want to reconstruct the continuum properties that are, you know, large-scale continuum properties from the discrete structure. And that's what we will eventually try to get. So here's the hypothesis. Basically, that the underlying structure of space-time is a causal set or locally finite full set. So we're motivating it this way, that order plus number gives you geometry. But now we want to be much bolder. You want to throw away the continuum and say, really, space-time, when we talk about quantum space-time, the objects to look at are these causal sets or locally finite full sets. And we have conditions of acyclicity and transitivity, but we also have this additional condition of local finiteness, which says that between any two elements, the intervening elements, okay, that's the future of one and the past of the other, the number of those elements has to be finite. So here's an example of a causal set, which looks nothing like the continuum, for reasons that will only become apparent when I tell you what I mean by something that looks like the continuum. So we want to include in here things that are not at all like space-time. We want to include, have a very large set of things. And as we go along, we'll see what kinds of things can happen. But as I said, this is not Biako.
Do the links have errors?
Yes, they do. So there is a this before that.
So in that cartoon that you drew, is there a sense in which you could draw an error?
Yes, of course, and that's upward. So I'm sorry, I have not. It's always upward. So the way, this is what we call a Hasse diagram. In fact, I have not put in all the relations.
So two things can lead to one.
Yes, and you know, there can be a lot of connectivity. The only thing that cannot happen is an arrow that comes back to itself, right? I mean, a set of arrows that comes back to itself. So no closed causal loops, but everything upward and anything you like. It's a very general structure. That's what is amazing about it. Also, what makes it a very hard thing to deal with. Okay, so we have a lot of engineering to do in being able to extract information. But I'll say a few words about this later. So as I said earlier, I mean, you could have stopped there. They could have stopped there in 1987 and said, okay, this is just, you know, space-time is just now a causal set, and, you know, this is what a causal set is. It's partially ordered set, and that's it. But what's very important, because it's being motivated by this HKMM theorem, is the continuum approximation. It's not any old theory of posets. Okay? Causal sets is not any old theory of posets. It's a particular one where the continuum approximation must reflect this HKMM theorem. The reason I say that is because there are other approaches, more recent ones, one, for example, that Lee Smolin and Marina Cortes work on called energetic causal set. But that class of theories does not incorporate the continuum approximation. So I want to make it clear that this particular approach, and again, everything was set out in the 1987 paper, the continuum approximation is very essential to the way in which this theory is defined.
So I think that part I'm a bit confused by is, when you say essential, I mean, I don't understand where it is essential.
Okay, and so in the sense that, how do I say when a causal set looks like spacetime?
Okay, so it may or may not, depending on what I do with it, it may or may not look like a spacetime.
Yeah.
Okay.
But when it does, mm-hmm. how do I know? How will I recognize? So I have a theory which produces causal sets, say, in whichever way, in a sum over histories, path integral, or some funny Cauchy evolution which you can make, depends on what you want to do. A Hamiltonian description of causal sets, you can do anything because it's a theory of Bose sets. Now, at the end of the day, your theory produces a wave function that's peaked on a class of causal sets. Now, what do you say? How can you say whether it's like spacetime or not? And I think the important thing here is that because it's fundamentally discrete, you don't want to take the continuum limit. The continuum limit is unphysical because the continuum is deemed unphysical. Okay? So what's very important and essential is the continuum approximation. So which is basically this idea that in the continuum, order and number should be space-time geometry, right? So this relation, this way that we are thinking about it. So how do we define that continuum approximation? Let's go to the continuum and look at if indeed the spacetime here, this, you know, Minkowski spacetime here is discrete, fundamentally discrete, what is the causal set which is underlying this continuum structure, right? I mean, how can I extract out the causal set from that? If I did a naive discretization, which is a regular lattice, and here's a light cone lattice, and then I said, well, let's look at that black box there and count the number of elements in there and say, well, there's a number to volume correspondence here. So I get the volume element. Then I find, of course, that under a boost of this lattice, I will not get that. More generally, you want this relation to hold covariantly. You don't want it to be dependent on a coordinate system or any of that, because really this statement in the continuum, which is that causal structure plus volume is equal to space-time geometry, is a covariant statement about the geometry. So you want that covariance to also reflect in the discretization. So if you took a regular discretization, you're not going to get anywhere. You will not be able to retain this number-to-volume correspondence. So what did they do in this 1987 paper? They said, well, let's instead consider a random lattice, okay? And in particular, one that's obtained by a Poisson process. So you go to the continuum, any continuum spacetime you like, and you obtain from it a distribution of causal sets, an ensemble of causal sets, via a Poisson sprinkling. And this is actually very essential even when we're doing phenomenology of causal sets. So please ask questions about this. I mean, I can cut out other parts of the talk. This is two-dimensional Minkowski spacetime. And here are some points that I've sprinkled onto it via this Poisson process, where V here is a spacetime volume. So for every spacetime volume, you have, on an average, and this is what results from the Poisson distribution, that on an average, it's related to the volume, space-time volume, okay? So it's not in every thing that N and V will have a direct correspondence, but on average, it's true, okay? And rho is the discreteness scale that you pick. So when I take a space-time, I do this Poisson sprinkling, I extract out an ensemble of causal sets that the space-time is an approximation of, okay? So this is the kind of thing that you will get, this sort of mess of a structure, and I've drawn in all possible relations. And just to sort of, this is a very nice quote from Finkelstein's paper on Riemann's dilemma, which is that one of the things we're always told is that if you have discreteness, then you're going to lose symmetries. Okay? And this is, an essential feature of causal sets. So let me emphasize this a little. Which is that, so Riemann's dilemma is a discrete manifold has finite properties, whereas a continuous manifold does not. Natural quantities are to be finite. The world must be discrete. Okay? So you may not agree with this line, but here's his dilemma. A discrete manifold possesses natural internal metrical structure, whereas a continuous manifold must have its metrical structure imposed from without. So in other words, all we have is the causal set. Everything is contained in order. Okay? The discrete has the volume. It has a causal structure. We don't need to impose anything like a metric on top. So we satisfy that. But then he has this dilemma. A continuous manifold has continuous symmetries, whereas a discrete manifold does not. Nature possesses continuous symmetries. The world must be continuous.
Can I ask a question? And maybe this is totally inappropriate.
Please, no, go ahead. Yeah.
So the first is a question, the second is a comment. The first question is, when you did that picture with the spikes and so on, if you're starting off with a finite or a discrete set of points, you must be assuming something. If you don't assume anything about the topology, there could be holes, it could be...
I completely, yes, no. So
there are some assumptions.
So I have not... So right now I'm talking about the continuum approximation. So I'm making an implicit assumption that there is a continuum. I mean, I'm making an assumption... So let me put it this way. I'm saying, let's take a continuum space-time, and we're asking, what is a causal set? I mean, it's like saying, here's a table, it's continuous, and I'm going to look for the atoms or the molecular structure underneath it, okay? And I'm going to sort of shed the skin of, you know, this apparition of continuity, and I'm going to find the structure within it, and that's what I'm doing to space-time.
But you haven't gotten rid of everything, right? I mean,
I do.
Holes.
You can have holes, you can do whatever you like.
This
is for just Minkowski space-time. If there was a hole, then I would not sprinkle in the hole. I would, if the hole was of size significantly larger than the discreteness scale. So let me just draw something like this. Let me cut out this huge region here in between. Then I would not have a relation that takes you from here to here.
You'd have to know the hole was there, right?
Yes.
It's not just discrete structure. It's this discrete structure plus some other.
Yeah. So I think I'm not communicating the following, which I should try to do a little bit more carefully, because right now it's true that if I just had the discrete structure, I could have different discrete structures. I could have, and really that's what my theory is. My theory is one just about causal sets. But I would like to know when I'm doing a theory of causal sets, which of those causal sets look like space-time, okay? So I'm trying to make a map between things that are continuum-like, causal sets which are continuum-like, and the continuum. That's my continuum approximation. It's not all of causal sets, but in order to make that comparison, I'm trying to do the other way. I'm trying to say, well, if I had a continuum, what would be the causal sets that I can extract?
It was my mistake. When you said you'd shred got rid of the background manifold, I thought we were already there.
Not yet.
No.
So right now I'm trying to say, what is we're still using, like we use the Hawking-Malamud theorem to leapfrog into this. We're going to use again the continuum to understand what a continuum-like causal set is.
So my
then we will ultimately only want to work the other way around.
My other comment was a technical question. I'm not actually sure if this is true, but isn't it true that there's a theorem that says that every differentiable manifold can be endowed with a metric?
With the Riemannian metric, yes.
No, Lorentzian.
Not every Lorentzian metrics require some more.
I thought it was proved in the semantics.
I mean, there are topology changes and cobordism.
That's whether or not you want causality conditions. So the implicit here is always some causality condition. Certainly that's not true. I mean, if you demand absence of causal loops, for example, cycles, then no compact closed manifold could do that. But even if you relinquish that and just say you'll accept any globally Lorentzian metric, it's necessary that the manifolds admit a nowhere vanishing vector field, or
line field.
A line field, nowhere vanishing.
So there is such a theory which comes with extra.
Yes. So not all spaces will allow, like Raphael said, for example, if you had an S4, you know, unless you allow singularities, you can't put a Lorentzian metric on it. And likewise, with other kinds of cobordisms, you can't always. And there's a nice paper by Raphael and one by Garouche, which describes, basically uses this theorem, which says when you can put it. So unlike Riemannian geometries, which you can put on any topology, every topology paracompact space will allow you to put a Riemannian metric on it, but not so with Lorentzian spacetime.
Okay.
So, all right, so
it's a fairly weak condition in some sense.
Okay, so all right. So one of the questions that you then want to ask is, here is a discretization. So is Riemann's paradox or dilemma a valid thing to worry about now? Does this, which looks like Minkowski, violate Lorentzian invariance? And oops, I think I skipped one. Yeah. And the very interesting sort of, I suppose, to many people is that discreteness does not actually violate Lorentzian invariance. This is very much a very important feature of causal sets. This is work done by Bombelli, Henson, and Sorkin in 2009, and very recently there's been some new work on sort of ironing out some of the details, sort of answering some of the skepticism that's come into this proof, about this proof. I'm not sure why there was skepticism, but there was. So the idea is basically, if I look at, so let me start with this, that I have a given manifold, and here I'll just look at Minkowski spacetime, and I can extract from it the ensemble via this Poisson sprinkling of causal sets, right? And then I have this set of all time-like directions which forms these units. So the future time-like directions forms this hyperbola, and this one is another one, right? The past forms another hyperbola. And this is different from the Riemannian case. If I look at unit directions, then it's just a sphere. And really, the essence of this comes from the fact that, unlike in Riemannian space, the hyperbolae are non-compact. Okay? So the question that you want to ask is there any way of assigning a direction to the space of sprinklings? Can I break Lorentzian invariance by finding a way to write down a vector, okay, like a direction? And consistency is important because I want that under a boost that this direction vector, you know, transforms in the right way under the boost. And this is what one calls equivariance. Because we're using a Poisson process, this is sort of an important thing, that the measure that you get, there's a measure on the space of directions which preserves volume and is Lorentzian invariant, okay? And this is some theorem that, from Stoyan's book, I think, which is also very important. So the Poisson process actually seems to be very essential to this proof. I'm not sure if one can do it without, but...
You said a measure on the space of directions. Mm-hmm. Did you mean a measure on the space of sprinkling?
On sprinkling, sorry. I meant here, because then I will show that the measure on the space of directions does not exist. That way I will sort of point out that doesn't exist. measure on the space of this ensemble of causal sets that I get, and the theorem says that there's no measurable map which is equivariant. This is the same condition that it's preserved under Lorentz transformations. And the point is this, that even though it looks like you could just draw an arrow, okay, and you could just say, well, here's a direction for a causal set, the point is that under a Lorentz transformation, it should go to another direction. And because we know of this Lorentz invariant map, measure, on the space of sprinklings, that induces a measure on the space of directions, which has to be Lorentz invariant. But now look at the space of directions. In Riemannian space, the space of directions is a unit sphere, right? I mean, it's just a unit sphere. And it's a compact thing. So if you have something that's rotationally invariant, right, you can consider something that's rotationally invariant. So it's the same everywhere. But if a measure is the same on a non-compact space, that means that the measure is zero. Because if it was it's non-compact and it's constant, basically what you're saying is it's a constant thing on an infinite space, but it's a measure, which means that it has to integrate out to one. So that means it must be zero. So that's the essence of this. And I think it's a beautiful theorem. Anyway. However, so what we do have then, what this says is that even though it's discrete, it satisfies Lorentz invariance, okay? In the sense that there are no preferred directions, okay? But what we do, What happens then is that you have discreteness, you have Lorentz invariance, but combined, they give rise to something which makes life very hard for those of us who work in causal sets, exciting and hard, but also gives rise to important features, which is non-locality. And by non-locality here, let me make it clear that we're not talking about acausal, nothing acausal. It's non-local in a very specific sense. So that's again, all of this, when I'm talking about it, I'm talking about it only in the continuum approximation. We've not yet come to the full description of the full quantum theory and the issues that are related to this. Okay.
So I want to take some issue with it because, I mean, it seems that you kind of doing this whole thing backwards because, I mean, you would think you first want to have a dynamics for causal sets and then prove that it's Lorentz invariant. If you don't have it, I mean, you assume already there's a sprinkling in a continuum, and of course that there's a, you kind of inherit the Lorentz invariance.
So I can, you know, maybe as I go over the talk, I'm approaching it, and I mean, it's true, I'm trying to be pedagogical in a particular way that I think is natural to be pedagogical in, but I can understand that it's leading to confusion. But I will come to this issue that ultimately, you know, if it is a theory of causal sets, we would like then that the dynamics in the right limit gives you things that look like the continuum, look like De Sitter space, for example, and in that, but here's a question then to you, is that if it did, how would you know? If I don't tell you how to make a map between the causal set and the continuum, I first need to construct the, I mean, so the way I see it is that the construction of that correspondence between the continuum and the discrete is very essential to the program. And then, of course, yes, I will come to.
Things is kind of but your wish list rather than.
Let me just go to the first slide. That's where.
Yeah.
I wanted to discuss the continuum approximation and kinematics, and then the quantum dynamics and where we're at and where we're struggling and so on. I mean, it's not
okay.
Yeah.
So maybe I missed. Okay. So I guess the question is Lorentz invariance something that? But I guess what you were saying that Lorentz invariance plus discreteness leads to non-local. So I guess maybe that I don't dispute that. I'm just saying that. Knowing that you get Lorentz invariance, it's not guaranteed until you actually know the dynamics that.
Sure. If you don't get something that looks like space-time, you don't even know what you mean by Lorentz invariance, I think. I mean, if you just have, give me a causal set that's random, you know, if you give me the Schleichmann-Rothschild, for example, I wouldn't be able to tell you what I mean by Lorentz invariance.
But I guess another way of thinking about it is that, like, what do people call a microcausality in context of quantum field theory is that you do have the support outside the light cone. And you would think that, I mean, in quantum field theory, there is nothing. So the commutators vanish outside the light cone. Here, continuum is an approximation. So you imagine there would be some tail outside the light cone. Probably you wouldn't get exactly zero outside the light cone. And is that a violation of causality, or what do you say? Or Lorentz invariance?
I think it's a very complicated question, partly because I think there's several ways in which one can think about it, but also, partly because we struggle with interpretation questions and so on, but suppose we did have an interpretational framework where we could say, well, here's a class of histories, and somehow they're dominating, they're the ones that happen. And in that class of histories, of course, I could have things that look, you know, with different, you know, things that look like space-time, but are different space-times. Mm-hmm. Then you have to ask, well, what is the sense in which things are actually leaking out? So for every given realization, every given causal set, you expect that there is no leaking out at the microscopic level. There isn't.
Yeah.
Now, the question is that when things interfere and so on, you know, whether there are observables, perhaps, that can potentially leak out. I don't know, maybe Rafael has a better answer to this, but I think we just have no, we don't understand a lot of the quantum gravity.
Well, I mean, there seem to be three questions. One is about Lorentz invariance, one is about causality relations,
mm-hmm.
like this micro causality. And the third one is about smearing of light cones by quantum gravity effects.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure which one.
I'm
the first one, I think. I don't think anything you said casts doubt on Lorentz invariance. The only thing is that it is not claimed that there's in the fundamental dynamics some notion of Lorentz invariance. This is a kinematic one.
Yeah, this is just, kinematic.
What I'm trying to say is that there's
nothing.
I'm just trying to say, so I think you're talking about a fundamental notion.
Let me say about there are, if you fix a causal set, there are theories of quantum scalar fields, as you know, the one Magdiev, Tsiavash started from, and so on. That they are these theories of scalar fields on a causal set, which have strict vanishing of commutator outside the light cone. There's no light cone, it's not no cone literally, but space-like related elements, the fields. Operators on those points strictly commute. So that's fully respecting what you might call micro causality. But then the third question, but now in the real quantum gravity theory, we have, in some sense, that's still not totally clear, some superposition of causal sets. Does this mean that you can have some smearing of the light cone? That's nothing to do with discreteness, really. It's a question any quantum gravity theory would face. And I think I couldn't say anything more than what Suma just said. It's not a totally well-posed question yet.
Mm-hmm.
But one would probably expect, yes, in some sense, there has to be a smearing, whatever that means as a light cone. I don't know if that answers the question.
But I think you're answering these questions from a fundamental point of view, which are very different questions. But I think from an operational point of view, if you send an experimentalist goes and test Lorentz invariance, these are really all interconnected. What you do is that you do an experiment here and you say, okay, does the result of this experiment affect something further out? And those are observables that we're talking about. So until we actually define those observables in some way.
You have to have the background space time. Even to ask that.
I mean, like, for example, the example is like Mehdi's work on dark matter. So the idea there is that the processes in the universe produce the excitations of this field that acts as some sort of an, I guess, the dark matter is the kind of ether that permeates the universe. So even though fundamentally those fundamental fields commute outside the light cone, you do have this background that violates Lorentz symmetry spontaneously, but nevertheless does violate it. So an experimentalist who makes experiments, gravitational experiments, would see that there's a preference.
Well, is it a spontaneous violation? Or is it just picking up on the cosmic restroom?
Yeah.
I mean, it's generated in the early universe. And the FRW space-time has a preferred restroom.
Yeah. So but I'm saying you can do experiments in this room, but and then the experiments wouldn't be frame independent because of this background that was created in there.
No, it's only insofar as we are not living in a Lorentz invariant spacetime. I mean, we are in FRW. Is it any different?
So I guess
if the effects are somehow, enhanced because of discreteness, I don't think is the case. I think it's simply that it's the same thing that you would say.
Responsible for generating that background.
I mean,
but the question is discreteness consistent with Lorentz invariance itself? And so discreteness does produce this background, and it does spontaneously break Lorentz symmetry in the sense that, okay, I mean, same as anything it does.
Not this one.
I mean,
when I say, okay, so let me make, FRW will, of course. So when I say Lorentz invariance, I will say more generally, I should say, local Lorentz invariance. So that's what I mean. And so local Lorentz invariance is not broken. Okay, so let's be very clear. I didn't mean global, obviously, because we don't live in a, hopefully, don't live in a, right. So I'm very out of time, and I've hardly said anything. So I want to know from you whether I can continue or, maybe break up the talk into another piece, which I can give later, because I've hardly touched.
Probably continue for, 20 minutes. If there's, I hear
okay.
Serious objections, probably 20 minutes.
Yeah, you can riot and say, I can stop. Okay.
I do have a very general question that possibly is better. We'll come back to. In this process, eventually you're going to have a discrete set of objects.
Yes.
And there'll be some notion of some discrete transformations, Lorentz transformations. And then you're going to somehow take a continuum limit, and then you have to look at the quantum gravity.
Yeah.
At what point do you expect the continuous Lorentzian transformations to emerge? At the end of the process?
Yes. I mean, I think that we would expect, so whatever dynamics, I will sort of go over that. I mean, I've kind of done it in a particular way that maybe it's not apparent, but if you allow me to go to the part where I describe dynamics and what our expectations of it are, then maybe it'll become a little clearer. What are the things we require? We need something like covariance, not Lorentz invariance, something like covariance, and that's very natural to the causal set. So those are things we put in to the theory and the dynamics, and we try to get out at the end of the day. And of course, we're not there. So I'm not saying this is a program that's very much a work in progress. But here are the ingredients and where we are, I will describe a little bit about that. So importantly, this non-locality. So if I look at other kinds of discretizations, like I did, like a simplicial decomposition, in four dimensions, if I did a simplicial decomposition, three dimensions, which is what I've shown here, then I look at the dual graph that I have. So with every center, I look at this graph that I construct that has a finite and a fixed valency. Okay, it has a finite connectivity and a fixed and finite connectivity. However, in the causal set, the number of nearest neighbors. So here, of course, in this graph, when I say valency, I'm looking at the set of nearest neighbors, okay? So in the causal set, because of this fact that automatically you have Lorentz invariance, if you look at the number of nearest neighbors, if I just look at this particular element here, the number of nearest neighbors is going to lie within the hyperboloid and the light cone, which is a unit space-time volume away, okay? The discreteness scale. And as you can see, it can go anywhere up the light cone in Minkowski spacetime. So in Minkowski spacetime, the set of nearest neighbors is infinite. For every element, the set of nearest neighbors is infinite. It's unbounded. Okay. And this is what gives rise to a very characteristic feature about causal sets, makes things very hard. There is also no possibility of a Cauchy evolution on causal sets. And that's because if I take what is the natural definition of a Cauchy hypersimplicity.
Because you go to all of any other.
Yeah, if you look at it, so it's infinite because if I look at these two, if I look at the light cone and I look at this hyperboloid, there will always be something way, that's right, it's unbounded, it's non-compact. I can just go really way up. Now, always, for any finite distance, I can go further up and I will find something that is. So this is these are the invariant hyperbolae that we learn about in special relativity. So Cauchy hypersurface, you have a natural definition of a space-like hypersurface, which is a set of unrelated points. There's no relation between them, these red points here. And I make it maximal. So everything is either to the future, everything else is either to its future or to its past. So I'd imagine that that's a good candidate for a space-like hypersurface. But what I find is that it's very leaky. It's what Raphael says, it's called the Cauchy sieve, because it leaks. And that's because there's a relation here between P, which is in the past of this, and Q, which is the future, which does not mediate, which there's a relation, a fundamental relation between them, what we call a link, which does not mediate through this Cauchy, this what I thought was a Cauchy hypersurface. So there's no natural way of doing Hamiltonian evolution, so one has to resort to a more space-time point of view, a more path integral point of view. I'm actually going to skip this, but there's this idea of a fundamental conjecture. I'll just very quickly say it, which is that if you have two space-times and a causal set that approximates two different space-times, the idea is that those two different space-times will only differ on scales of the order of the discreteness scale. They are approximately the same, because if they weren't, then going back all the way to the HKMM theorem with the Hawking-King-McCarthy-Malamud theorem, that means that the causal set hasn't captured all of the important geometrical information. Yes?
It's another way of saying that they have the same continuous limit.
The limit would be the wrong thing to say, because the two continuum spacetimes are in fact distinct. There's a little bit of structure on scales smaller than the discreteness scale. So the limits would not, if I made the denser and denser and denser, then there would be a point at which these two will distinguish between those spacetimes. But if I set the discreteness scale, then those spacetimes can only differ on scales smaller than the discreteness scale. So the next picture sort of says that if that same thing cannot then be correspond to something which is vastly different, a spacetime which is vastly different. Okay, an important part is constructing. So going now, doing the other way around, which is if I have just order, can I construct things, can I construct geometry just from order? Okay, can I construct things like dimension, geodesic distance, etc., from this? And the answer is yes. And there are many such things that one has done over the years. Various people have contributed to this. Dimension estimator, time-like distance, reconstruct spatial homology. And all of these have continuum. You're just taking we're using only the information in the causal set. And we show that when there is a continuum approximation, when that causal set is continuum-like, then that thing that we've created corresponds in the right limit to the continuum structure that we, you know, the things that we see and we think of as the continuum. Okay? So this is an entire program of geometric reconstruction. There's importantly an action, which is the Einstein-Hilbert action, which I'll talk about hopefully. I mean, I'm so out of time that I'm just waiting for you to cut it off. But anyway, I mean, I can always discuss this in any of our free times later.
Yeah. We're going to have more time than somebody thinks.
For people like me, it's useful to go slowly.
Okay, great. Okay.
So
that's...
I don't know that you gave maybe... I'm happy to continue. I'm not rushed to eat. So.
And that's actually a good point, that maybe going more than an hour, it's going to be harder for people to digest if it's on you.
I'm very happy to continue, but I'd love a coffee.
Okay, so maybe we can just take a break and come back.
Probably lunch before coffee.
Okay, yeah. Whatever. I'll let you decide, because the next thing is sort of broader, you know, where, so tying it all together, because so far I've just been talking about the continuum approximation, things to do with the continuum, but we can do this whenever you want to.
Sure.
Okay.
The rest of this one. Okay, so any questions for Sumati before we wrap up for lunch? Yeah. You want to ask?
So this list of papers that you mentioned, are you going to say more about?
No, I wasn't going to say very much about these in this talk. I will say a few. I will say something about this Benincasa-Dow correction. Just a few words, and you'll hear more about some of this in about the Dallenberg in Niasha's talk. Related to scalar field green functions.
No, I would more. So I guess it's a more general talk, general question. So, you define the causal relationships. Is that what is the most important ingredient in later mapping onto geometry? Or is it also an additional ingredient, which is how exactly you map? So what is the more...
So let me see if I can answer that coherently. Suppose I have a causal set. I'm just drawing it. I don't mean it to be a sprinkling, but secretly I'm doing it as a sprinkling. But I get this causal set, and I've got just the order relation, but I also have number, right? What is essential when I want to make the map is that I've got to say, what is the density, right? I have a cutoff. I have the continuum, but I also have a cutoff, right? So let's imagine, as we were earlier, we have two spacetimes which differ have the difference in those two spacetimes, some structure which is at the scale of the cutoff or smaller than the scale of the cutoff. That means I've given you a cutoff. So there's a density involved. Now, if I increase the density, I will soon start to see that structure, right? So when I talk about these maps, I need to define for you also what the density is in which I'm making the correspondence, right? An example of that is, suppose I had a five-dimensional spacetime with a Kaluza-Klein direction. If I had a sprinkling density which could see that direction, if I looked at a coarse graining of that, I wouldn't see that extra dimension. So there's a sense, it's very important in the continuum approximation, when you say, well, this causal set looks like that spacetime, you have to ask the question, at what scale does it look like it?
Is that density always uniform? Or is it something that...
Yeah, so So the uniformity of the density is very important, because it is something that's to do with the Poisson distribution. And it comes with a measure of that spacetime, right? So that... the volume element there of the that comes in the spacetime. So it's not uniform in the sense of every, obviously, because it depends on the metric, but it's uniform with respect to the volume element of the metric.
And not only uniform, but it has to be of a fixed density physically, right? There should be some fundamental length, which we don't know what it is, but everyone would expect up to a factor of order unity, it's equal to the Planck length. So the fundamental correspondence between the causal set and the space-time would be via one of these embedding, what we call faithful embedding, which is like a sprinkling at unit density in fundamental units.
But this,
of course, one could go further and say, can I have a sort of RG procedure where I wash out some information? That you can do. That's, I think, what Sumati is referring to.
So,
it's by sprinkling at a lower density.
Yeah.
So like a Kaluza-Klein spacetime would start to look like four dimensions instead of five or whatever.
So in other words, I mean, one of the...
Density, but there is some part of the theory, there is some basic density, which is a basic parameter of the theory.
But we don't... So for example, you could have, even though you have a fundamental n scale, you could... I mean, if your dynamics, for example, spat out something that doesn't, you know, in its detail look like Planck scale continuum, it doesn't look like the continuum at a sprinkling density corresponding to the Planck scale, but it does look like something like the continuum at much larger scales, I would still be happy with that, right? I mean, if that because at the smallest scales, maybe the structure is really not like the continuum at all. So it's only in some coarse graining that you get out something that looks like the continuum, and that's, but then it should really have all the information in it. So order, so I think, I don't know, maybe I can just go back to that particular slide. This is kind of the important thing. The discrete order should give you everything about the geometry. That's it. All the things we see and, you know, love about the continuum geometry should come out of that. And that's the whole, this whole program of what we call geometric reconstruction.
So what determines the end geometry that you get is in the way you sprinkle.
It's in the way it...
Sprinkling has a measure in it.
Yes.
Sitting in the exponent and you...
That's right. In the only thing that's there... Okay, so let's go back to the...
Sprinkling equation.
Yes. This guy here. So what do we have? This V is the continuum object. Okay, that's so you can ask the question, So when I say C, secretly here is a density. I have to tell you when, at what density is this true? And everything else comes from the volume comes from here, and the number comes from here. And it's a way of embedding C, it's what we call a faithful embedding of C into this manifold, where the order relations that are there here should correspond, once you embed it, should be reflected in the causal ordering in the spacetime. Okay? So in other words, I have a causal set, I want to embed it into this. Can I first of all embed it? It's not always true that I can embed every causal set into every spacetime. And the embedding just requires me to see that the order relation here corresponds to a causal ordering relation in the spacetime, that's all. But I also want to make sure that the embedding satisfies the number to volume relation. So not only do I want it to be a causal embedding, which is that the order corresponds to causal order, but I also want the number to volume relation to be true. Does such an embedding exist? That's the question. If such an embedding exists, then I will say this is continuum-like. Earlier, what I was doing is I was going the other way around. I was saying, starting with this manifold, what does the causal set look like? What does the ensemble of causal sets look like? Okay. The question that I will have to ask myself is, once I get this, will this be true?
Okay. So there's sort of a large variety of causal sets you can have, only some subset of them.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
But the way you actually engineer it, in this case, you sprinkle them subject to a constraint.
Yes.
That they will all be embeddable into M, onto M.
Right, I start off with M and I get out an ensemble, but ultimately what I want to be able to do is to take, generate from my dynamics causal sets and then see whether those causal sets have a correspondence in the continuum. If they do, I will say they're continuum-like. Okay? Yeah. Yes.
If I understood the previous comments correctly, there is a characteristic coarse graining scale which will be larger than the Planck scale.
That might be the case, yeah. That might well be.
And is that characteristic scale something that's input in the theory, or is it going to come out?
We don't know.
It's not meant to be input as a fundamental thing in the theory. No.
It's like a string.
But we don't know, as somebody says, we don't know for sure. But
it's like a string act in a string theory, right? That you have some basic, some dimensionless number, which is your scale compared to the Planck scale. Then you agree.
But I think we'd be happy. Yeah. I think we'd just.
That is the question of what is the fundamental length in this theory?
Yeah.
But then there's another question, is there some intermediate length, which is much bigger than, like Sumati said, one might expect, if you think of condensed matter animals, for example, you might expect that on very small scales you see something rather chaotic. It doesn't actually look much like a space-time. But on larger scale, after some coarse graining, here I mean a coarse graining of the causal set itself, after some coarse graining of the causal set, then it resembles a space-time. That could very well, I mean, I think that's the most natural anticipation.
It could be just like a 10-dimensional space-time.
Yeah, it could be 10-dimensional. It could be totally 10-dimensional.
It could be a 10-dimensional.
It could be 26-dimensional.
Yeah,
it can't be over about 500 dimensions. There's a hard limit.
No. Yeah, it doesn't have to be rational. Yes.
Well,
right. It's true. It's absolutely true. So what you're asking is an important question, because the dimension estimators that we have in four causal sets that are continuum-like, they will give you roughly the dimension of the, you know, of the continuum. But if I do it, if I calculate the same thing, which I can calculate in any causal set, because it just depends on the order, I will get things that are fractional, I will get all kinds of numbers, fractal dimensions, which are there. But in the continuum approximation, for causal sets that look like the continuum, that thing that I've calculated is in fact related to the... And this is the thing that for a typical causal set, so a few slides down, I would get to this. I'm sorry, I was really slow.
So your slides are arranged causally?
I don't know. Now I'm wondering, because, you know, maybe they were not all... It's just one particular logical one.
Make a comment. The thing I'm finding a little bit difficult, and it may be the same for others, is that I'm coming to it with an anticipated notion of doing everything discreetly.
Yes.
And things are being motivated for space-time, and I'm finding it a little bit hard to go from one.
Okay, I understand. I understand the perspective, which is why maybe when I go on to the part where we throw away the continuum, we're just looking at quantum dynamics and what we're trying to achieve with quantum dynamics. We haven't got there. Okay, so we're struggling in different directions, but there's an effort in different directions. And then the question of where does phenomenology fit in all this, right? That's very important, because that's what this whole meeting is about. So I wanted to get there, but I think I'll have to...
We're going to have lots of time to get there. I just should decide exactly when we should discuss each of these. And if there are things that somebody mentioned that you want to hear more about, just, I think, voice it, tell her or tell anyone. So we can kind of, maybe she can kind of spend more slides on that.
So how do we have our afternoon? So maybe I can just switch this off and...
Okay, so let's thank Sumati, and I guess we're going to break for lunch now.
New part of the talk that I didn't finish from the morning. So those of you who are waiting for Rafael's talk, don't go away. It's just 20 minutes down the line. So many more faces now than in the morning. So we were at this point when I was describing, just before I got to this, the geometric reconstruction and the kinds of things you can get from order, just from the order theoretic structure that allow you to recover geometry in the causal set. The postulate, causal set postulate, is that space-time is replaced by locally finite partially ordered sets or causal sets. And if you want to think in terms of the partition function, which in quantum gravity we have a partition function over all possible space-times, you know, with this particular weight, you can think of that being replaced, the path integral being replaced by a sum now over causal sets over some particular sample space, omega, with some measure. So this is what you would replace this continuum path integral with. And now by summing over all possible causal sets, we're looking at things that are not just those that come from continuum spacetimes. Okay? So we've now looked, now this is how we want to set up the theory, the full theory. So far we've just looked at things that are the continuum approximation, and now we ask, well, what is that, this theory that's replacing the continuum theory? And it is some version of this. Okay? One question is, if I look at this sample space here, and let's for now just look at the set of causal sets of a given cardinality, of a given size, given n, okay? And say, what does a typical causal set look like? Does it look like continuum? And in fact, it looks quite the opposite. It looks completely not like the continuum in the sense that we have of the continuum approximation. It's a three-layered causal set. These are things that we call the Kleichmann-Rothschild causal sets. And these look nothing like space-time. So omega here is dominated, entropically dominated, by things that look nothing like space-time. And this theory that we want to construct should have in its full sample space such objects as well. Okay? N is the total size of the causal set. So an N element. We're not looking at infinite causal sets, but you can then look at how this behaves asymptotically. So this is really true only in the large N limit, that this is how these things dominate the space of causal sets. So really what you have is this space much, much larger than the continuum space times we were talking about earlier. Okay? So whatever dynamics I construct will have to overcome this entropy. Mu here is something that we would more generally call a quantum measure. And this is something that this idea goes back to Sorkin. And this comes with this idea comes a lot of issues on quantum interpretation, which I won't say anything about. So there's two approaches to dynamics. One, and again, this is very quick. I don't intend to go into any detail, but just to give you a broad overview, sequential growth, where the idea, and this, for those of you who do cosmology, it's very reminiscent of how you think of, you know, the Big Bang and so on and so forth. The idea is, what is a natural initial condition you might want for something that is countable? And that is to start really with nothing, the empty set, then add one element. Okay, that's this first element here. Then you want to go on adding elements step by step, but you want to make sure that you respect causality at this fundamental level or the order relation. So you want to make sure that the new element that's added is never to the past of the existing one. It's always either to the future or unrelated. Okay? So that's something you want this dynamics to have. So you're growing causal sets. That's the dynamics of causal sets, but you're growing, starting from a single element, into something that's a countably finite causal set. These models, so one of the things you want, like I said, is causality, but you also want covariance. And this is where the issue that we was earlier brought up on Lorentz invariance and things like this. Here we have a rudimentary notion of a covariance, which is label invariance. It doesn't matter how that causal set was grown. Whatever the probability, either the quantum amplitude or the classical amplitude, or classical probability, shouldn't depend on how you got to that particular causal set, how you grew this. So here's an example of three causal sets, which are really one and the same. They're just differently labeled depending on which time they came. But since that shouldn't matter, the only thing that matters is order, these three should come with the same amplitude or the same probability, depending on whether you're in the quantum or the classical case. You also want this Bell causality of spectator independence, and some version of this, I suspect, Rafael will say something about this, or maybe not quite. Okay, all right. So I was hoping to hear a little bit about this, but and In these models, these are Markovian.
Tomorrow,
he's got some, okay, it's not related to this, but it has to do with Bell inequalities, I suppose, right? Causality. Okay, all right. Okay, the title changed. And so the other thing that we want in these sorts of models is stochasticity, so something like a Markovian evolution. And this is one class of models. The other is a continuum-inspired dynamics, where you just consider a partition, look at the partition function, which is the sum over all causal sets in a given sample space, and you weigh it in the way that you would do in the continuum, which is you look at the discrete version of the Einstein-Hilbert action. And this is the Benincasa-Dauker action. I already mentioned it. I think Yasaman will talk about this tomorrow in more detail. But basically, this action is, again, just constructed out of counting things. Here you count how many elements are pure links, that is just related to one another without an intermediary element in between. And then you also have to count objects like this and objects like this and so on. And you have this very nice alternating sum. And when you put that together, you get the action. And that's what you would weigh this with. Okay? Again, not much detail, but the question is that, so there are two ways of proceeding. One is through this more fundamental dynamics, which is sequential growth, and the other is just trying to write down a partition function, just as you would in other approaches to quantum gravity. So the question, of course, is where are we? So in the sequential growth models, what's very important is to try to construct quantum sequential growth models. And one of the questions that comes up is whether the quantum measure, when we put it into this framework, whether this exists or not. And there's several sort of directions in which we're going. And just to say that it depends very much on the class of models that you have, whether this quantum measure itself exists. And trying to construct observables and so on, we have an idea of how to proceed in this direction. But of course, we're very far from anything like a realistic, full realistic, dynamics for causal sets. The other way of proceeding is to just start off, like I said, the continuum-inspired way, which is to look at the partition function. And you can ask the question, well, can we look at this and say, what sets of causal sets might be suppressed because we have this enormous entropy there, which is of things that are not continuum-like. Can we look at partitions of this space and see whether certain parts of this are suppressed or not? And there's been some progress in this by Karlip and Loomis, trying to say that one particular class of causal sets is in fact suppressed over another, and which are non-manifold-like. But there's still a lot to be done even here. The thing that I have worked on quite a bit of late is using an analytic continuation, which takes the partition function. So you introduce a new parameter, and then you take that parameter and analytically continue it so that you go from a quantum theory of causal sets to a statistical theory of causal sets. And you can then put this on the computer and do lots of things with it. But really the question is, where are we? One thing we can do is define observables in the theory. And I think that's a huge progress, because one of the things that people struggle with is defining observable quantities in quantum gravity. For us, observables are very easy. They're order invariants. Anything that's order invariant is an observable. If it's a finite element causal set, for example, you can define the number of links, the number of fundamental relations that you have in that causal set. That is an observable. Okay? Some of these observables, when you put them together, give you things that, in the continuum approximation, correspond to geometric invariants, like space-time dimension. Okay, those are observables. So that's important. And when you have, for example, countable causal sets, like in the growth process, you can still define observables based on these things called stem sets. One thing I should point out is that even there are some observables which correspond to whether the universe is bouncing or not, and these are covariantly defined questions. Maybe in a discussion session I can describe those a little bit more. But here's the state that if the path is clear, technical hurdles are fairly great. And this is what happens with the sequential growth models. We know what to do in principle, but calculating things is really hard in that sequential growth process. And we are pushing and trying to understand more and more of quantum sequential growth, but I think there are several very difficult problems that we face. And if there's calculability, which we have with these Monte Carlo simulations, there is some conceptual difficulty because we don't really understand what the analytic continuation is doing. So this is sort of the honest state of affairs in terms of the quantum dynamics. But ultimately, of course, if we're doing quantum gravity, we also need a quantum theory of closed systems. And understanding that, understanding how to interpret the quantum measure is something that these are the open questions. So let's ask the question of relevance to this conference, which is what do we mean then by quantum causal set phenomenology? As I've told you, quantum causal set quantum dynamics is incomplete. We don't have real predictions from deep within the theory. Because we don't have, if we had solved quantum gravity, we'd be shouting it from the rooftops, but we haven't yet done that. So we don't know whether the continuum emerges from causal set quantum gravity. That's a big question. Certain limited cases, we have certain phases, and these are in these Monte Carlo type simulations. We can say in those phases, things that are continuum-like emerge. But like I said, there are issues with those. We can't still say that we understand that theory very well. It is, after all, just a statistical theory of causal sets. However, one thing we have to remember is that the continuum approximation itself has a very distinct quantum feel to it because of the fact that it's fundamentally discrete. Okay? You already have, at the kinematic level, a quantumness to causal sets, right? It's not a causal set per se, is not a classical object. Even if it has a continuum approximation, because it has the inbuilt discreteness, it's already quantum at the kinematic level. And there are characteristic features, which is discreteness, Lorentz invariance, non-locality, that can be explored. And this is really what causal set phenomenology is doing. It's not answering the question, well, does the continuum emerge from causal set quantum gravity? We don't know this yet. But it's asking, if it did, what would the effects of that fundamental discreteness be with its characteristic Lorentz invariance, with the non-locality? What does it do? So of course we're going to, so here's another example of continuum, but okay. So we have the topic of this meeting, of course, is Sorkin's 1987 prediction for this fluctuation in lambda. And I'm being very careful here. I'm not saying lambda itself, because we think that lambda being equal to zero must come from a more fundamental theory. Maybe, I mean, at least from my understanding of it so far. And there are these various ingredients, and I won't go into it because we're running it, and Raphael will talk about it very soon. But there are some other things that I just want to point to. A lot of interesting phenomenology which comes out of causal sets. And there's this one idea which is really very beautiful, which is the idea of swerves, which various people have worked on. Mattingly and Calliope have put observational bounds on things. And that's that if you have this random discreteness, then it already does something interesting to particles that are hopping around on this. Suppose you had a regular lattice, okay, so a nice, square lattice in space-time. then a particle hopping around would basically, a free particle would just go hopping around, a massive free particle would just go hopping around on a straight line. But in a causal set, which is random, there is no straight line. You can't really move in a straight line because you're sort of, it's random. There's no way to sort of make sure that you're in a straight line. So what does that mean? So that particles must swerve just a little because they're trying, even if they try to be straight, there's a little bit of a change in the momentum every time you try to be straight. So it's sort of going along a zigzag path. And the swerving is what results in a momentum diffusion in the manifold of states, which is basically the space-time times the mass shell for the momentum. Okay, this hyperbola H3 is a mass shell for the momentum. And this momentum diffusion, so if I look at a density of particles, here rho is the density of particles hopping around on the causal set, then I have a diffusion equation in momentum space plus something that depends on the spatial derivative of rho. And so here's an example of a swerving particle. It's trying to be as straight as possible, and there are different models for this, different ways you can model it within a causal set. But what this means, if you think about a momentum space diffusion, is that if you started off with a zero momentum state, right? So something that's stationary, stationary literally in the, and then you waited for long enough, because it's a diffusion in momentum space, it's going to pick up momentum immediately. But the tails of momentum will sort of thicken and thicken over time, right? And since the universe is long enough, the tails can go out significantly, and you can get very high energy particles as a result. So you think of a Gaussian that's spreading over time, but in momentum space. So it's going to larger and larger momentum, and it's picking up over time. And because the universe is so old, that could lead to some very interesting phenomenology. And this has been studied. So this has been thought of in the massive case, in the masses case. You have this parameter k, which is a diffusion constant, and the question of how do we constrain this parameter? How do we make these models actually consistent with, you know, generalizing this to curve space-time and so on? These are very interesting questions, and I think this phenomenology, unfortunately, nobody is really working on anymore, but is a very interesting...
You have mass of the particle sitting there, so would that be different for relativistic and non-relativistic?
This is a relativistic diffusion equation.
Right, but if you have a massive particle versus a zero mass particle.
Yes, yes. So the it changes. Yeah, it changes. The massless, there are two diffusion constants that come in, right? If I'm not mistaken, yeah, Rafael.
In the massless case, it's very different, actually.
So that could that lead to phenomenology in which where you look at differences in trajectories of photons in a non-relativistic manner? That's something that's observationally very easy to...
Oh, I see, okay.
It's easy. In the massless case, it's very easy to put bounds because of the thermality of the CMB.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very strong constraint.
Because of what?
The
thermality.
The fact that it's Planckian spectrum.
Planckian.
Thermality of the CMB. It turns out, it's another story, but it turns out that the kind of diffusion that can happen in momentum space for a massless particle would distort the shape.
Yeah.
Would not preserve a thermal distribution. So you can actually put quite strict bounds on the diffusion constant.
And this, I guess, the one for the massive case, you also put in bounds coming just from heating up of hydrogen,
yes,
in the lab.
Yeah, that's right, heating up.
You just want to make... But again, the question, you know, I think that there's a lot here that's not... I mean, we really don't know. We haven't, I think, done this calculation and say realistic cosmologies, looked at how this equation changes. So there's a lot of phenomenology. I just want to point out, there's a lot of phenomenology here that hasn't been explored, and I think it is has a potential of telling us, giving us some new I shouldn't say predictions, possibly predictions, but yeah, giving us something that might be one might be able to correlate with observation. And finally, just for the last bit, is study of non-local scalar field theories, and this has again given rise to a lot of interesting things. The Einstein-Hilbert action that one constructs uses a D'Alembertian operator, which is fundamentally non-local in character. So a continuum version of this would be an integral differential equation, it would be an integral operator rather than just a differential operator. It's an integral differential operator. And that changes the character of how scalar fields propagate on a causal set. And that can have very interesting associative phenomenology. Belenkia, Benincasa, and Liberati have looked at classes of non-local scalar field theories inspired by these non-local D'Alembertian operators. Not quite the same, but inspired by this. There is also a new way of thinking about the vacuum in quantum field theory, the Sorkin-Johnston vacuum, and lots of related work. And of course, finally, something that Naish will talk about is this idea that off-shell modes contribute to dark matter in using this idea of a non-local scalar field theory. So let me just end by saying that causal set phenomenology is rich, and I think we're just seeing the tip of the iceberg. The iceberg should be bigger than that, but thanks.
Thank you.